So, I want to welcome you all to Woman Made Gallery in its 22nd year. I always like to start by asking who is here for the first time. Wow. See, this is all part of my secret plan. Although I would love to have people come back just to listen, by doing these open calls, having people who come in from all over the place, as well as people from the Chicago area, come on in, have a seat. We get to expose more and more people to this amazing gallery, this creative home for women in the arts. One of the things that the literary series tries to do is to really kind of create a bridge between arts, both the visual and the literary arts. And so when the gallery has a themed exhibit, which in general all of our exhibits are, I try to come up with a restatement of that theme for the poets, potential poets, to handle. Now, last year when we were planning, I was told by the outgoing, the founding executive director, sorry, this one is about painting and drawing, and I know that doesn't really lend very well to for a reading theme, and we came up with the theme oil and water, which has a tremendous number of possibilities in it for poets. And somebody like me, this is like one of my favorite themes, is kind of black and white thinking. As a psychotherapist, black and white thinking and the need for nuance is kind of a constant theme that runs through my work. My second book is called The Uncertainty of Maps. The first is Conversations with Friendly Demons and Tainted Saints. So if that doesn't give you a sense of how much I love this theme, then I'll just tell you, I really am excited to hear this work. There were a number of other people who sent work in. I'm so sorry I couldn't have included. But we have six people who represent all different takes on the theme from the viewpoint of, from various viewpoints, some of which are really kind of viewpoints that are specific from the view that a woman brings to the world, whether it's through activism, through specifically women's issues, and then some that are just, you know, like we have Joyce, who did a response to the Magritte exhibit and the "Ceci n'est pas un pipe." Hey, I did that okay. So I'll just read a little bit of what I wrote for this theme, starting with "and or." We have also oil and water, friend, enemy, sink or swim. Some of these, like pregnancy, and you can't be half pregnant. You can't sink and swim. You either swim or you sink. Friend and enemy, on the other hand, not so much, not so easy to discern. So we'll see what takes the poets here have brought to this rich theme. I may stop at this point and begin our reading. We have We're going to start with, is there anything really important I should have said, Kurt, other than to introduce you? Kurt's like my outrigger. He makes sure I don't tip over. Kurt Heinz has worked with the gallery and myself for years at recording these events and keeping an archive that once it gets posted, which takes a little while of editing, and you will have access to it.
And it's current through the last occasion now.
Right.
Finally caught up.
And
so that's like 5 years worth of this stuff.
Yeah, that's a whole lot of poetry, a whole lot of wonderful writers. Is there anything else really important that I'm leaving out? Oh, yes, there is. Upstairs, this weekend has been the, if you're shopping for Christmas gifts or Hanukkah gifts and want to buy some art, almost everything upstairs is, or what's particularly in the midsection, is stuff that you may really want to take a look at, because you're giving a gift of love as well as supporting an artist, which we all know is really, really important.
Do you want to acknowledge the transition from Viata?
Yes. I mentioned that our outgoing founding ED, her name is Beata Minkowski, and she's kept this place alive and has brought around her a lot of people who are in love with the gallery. But without her, this place wouldn't be filled with the spirit it is, or have done the dirty work of keeping itself alive, you know, the scraping and the feeding itself. After 21, 22 years, she leaves, and the helm is being handed over to Claudine, and I think her last name is pronounced Issa. And I just spent an hour with her, and I'm really excited to see her begin on January 1, but she's been getting kind of deluged with 22 years of how things are done here. So, on that note, I'm going to start and bring up Marilyn Kavikia, who lives in Hyde Park. She's an editor at the ABA, American Bar Association, and a communications specialist at Chicago Child Care Society, an organization that I know fondly. Her first chapbook, Secret Rivers, received the 2013 Helen K. Chapbook Prize and was published by Evening Street Press in 2014. She has publications that range from places like Hawaii Review, Thema, and Dum Dum Zine. So, Marilyn, welcome for your first time at the gallery.
So, as Nina said, the poems I'm going to read are from my chapbook, Secret Rivers. This is a collection of persona poems in which everyone in the book is either driving or riding along a particular stretch of highway in Ohio. The area that they're riding or driving through is one that's deep in post-industrial decline. What has happened there recently is energy companies have come into town to begin a practice called fracking, which involves injecting gallons and gallons of fresh water into the earth to extract oil and gas. There's a layer of shale in that area. There's a vein of it called Marcellus and another called Utica. And these are both really prized areas for this practice. So for this area to be sitting right at the juncture of the two, it's kind of like the prime spot to be if you're into fracking. And of course, this brings up all kinds of different conflict. It's a real flashpoint for the conflict of oil and water, because what does it do to the groundwater supply, this extraction process? And there's conflict everywhere. what are we doing? Should we be doing this? And also, is our community going to sink or swim, ultimately? So the first poem is Justin, driver, Chevy Volt. I guess it figures around here that only the usual five of us would speak out at tonight's town hall meeting. One lady took a brochure, but I saw her wad it up in her purse, get back into her mega-large Hummer or whatever. That's the way it is. It'll be better next month in Columbus. I shouldn't have used terms like proppant and slickwater. I shouldn't have raised my voice. It was like yelling at my grandma. I definitely yelled at other people's grandmas. The ones talking about how they hope to get a nice check, how much they need it, how the company studies say there's very little risk, and how we don't want to miss this opportunity. I shouldn't have said it was an opportunity to poison grandbabies. I felt things turn then even further. It was easier in college talking to people my own age, people who wanted to save the world, people who didn't live in a world so far past saving, so many decades beyond saving, that fear begins to look like hope. Donna, driver, Chevy Tahoe. He seemed like a nice kid, reminded me a little bit of Corey, except this kid, Justin, would never be a Marine. But that's why I took his leaflet, because I believe in being respectful, even if I disagree with someone. It used to be that more of us were like that. I don't know how it happened that everyone argues so much now. Like we're all secretly on the radio all the time. Like each of us is our own entire talk station. I went to the meeting because it was a thing to do, and I know how to listen politely, even though of course I'm going to take the check. We have medical bills now, over and above Medicare. Our pension, such as it is, and Social Security only go so far. I would like a new gazebo for the yard. I want to sit out there with my coffee and watch the hummingbirds. That's when I'm not watching my grandbaby Kinsley, of course. And when am I ever not? Anyway, what they told me is that me signing over the rights to my yard does not necessarily mean that a well goes in tomorrow. It could be 30 years of checks each week and not even any drilling yet. 30 years is a long time, probably more than enough. Longer than we'd live without those checks, I'll tell you that. And then I don't think Kinsley would want to live here anyway. Kids never do. It's just the way things are, always kids wanting to go someplace else. Even my daughter Kim talks about that. Come back for visits, be as strange to us as that kid at the meeting. His family still lives here, and yet he seems so unsettled. Like he came from nowhere, doesn't know where to go next. It's always someone like that who wants to come in and save what's here, wants us to read the leaflets, save the world, save the same world they want to save, that is. John, driver, Ford F-150. If I get back to the room before Paul does, I can take over the TV so he can't turn on pay-per-view while I'm right there in the room on the other bed, and so he can't keep looking over at me like either he's really glad I'm there or like he wishes I weren't there so he could just go for it and not have to excuse himself, run the shower for 10 minutes like I don't know what he's doing, and like the walls aren't paper thin. I guess he's trying to be polite, though, which is good, and it's not like Trevor, who is always bringing hookers, though he always called them girlfriends and offering to share them, which I guess was another way of trying to be polite. I know we all have needs. Jesus, I know that. Away from my wife for 6 months now, and all the local girls so hungry for something. I don't know, maybe something I have. There's this one waitress I like, because you can tell she's taking it but not really taking it, you know? Like our small tips and dirty jokes aren't such insults, because she's stacking them up somewhere, turning them against us somehow. She's hot, too, of course, but I could never cheat on Melissa, maybe bring home some disease after all this, on top of everything else. Me being gone for these 6 months, gone I don't know how much longer. A while, I think, because the whole reason we're here is that under all this nothing, there's a hell of a lot of shale. Marcellus, Utica. Heather, driver, Kia Soul. My feet are killing me. I couldn't move fast enough. It used to be mostly two tops, maybe a four if you're lucky. Now we're doing six at a time, pulling chairs from the back. You've got to watch these guys, though. They're nice enough, I guess. I mean, really, they're fine. And nothing has happened. Just a comment or two here and there. They're just not from around here, you know? They're just not. They didn't know me in high school, they don't know my family, and I don't know theirs. I don't know where they all come from. Other states, other countries even. I don't know why. We still have a lot of people around here who would jump for those jobs. Even if they are dirty and loud, like I've heard. You know, my job is dirty and loud, too. So's everybody's. Everybody who has one, that is. This is Sophia Elena, driver, Nissan Altima. My mother told me it is cold here. I thought Ohio is near West Virginia, and West Virginia is near Virginia, and this is in the south of the country, but now there's snow. I have called the woman at the real estate office, the woman who showed me the apartment in the fall. I have said that I don't know how to drive in the snow, and also that I do not have the clothes for cold weather. She has told me nothing, this woman. I think that she and I will not be friends. Her voice says to me, "Why did not my husband get this job? Why are you coming here?" Her voice laughs at me because of these questions. I think that it is not my fault that the company believes an engineering degree is necessary in order to schedule the workers. I have this degree. If I'm not coming here, I'm working at the dam in Brazil. My mother prefers that. It is closer. She thinks that I will fall in love, stay here, even when 8 months is over. I do not see anything to love. I know there is shale under the snow, and gas inside the shale, and money to keep me here for 8 months. That is all. Julie, driver, Ford Taurus wagon. I'm showing apartments every day now. This one lady, she keeps calling me to complain about this and that. Her flight was delayed, and now there's a storm somewhere between Columbus and here. She's not used to driving in snow, and she doesn't have any sweaters. Listen, I'm not going to pick her up from the airport. And about the sweaters, I'm sure they have Google in South America, where she's from. She could have looked up our weather from there, especially if she's so brilliant that they have to import her from a whole other continent. All she is a scheduler. She schedules the workers. She must be damn good at it, is all I have to say. Joan, front seat passenger, Buick LaCrosse. I don't know why we have to go to Minton to visit Greg's mother. She doesn't even know us anymore. And when she did, she never liked me or even the children. It's all about Greg, always. The number one son, quarterback, love of her life. Because Donnie never amounted to anything. Left her after he died, in a broken house clinging to a broken mountainside. Everything here will collapse sooner or later. That's what will come of all this fracking. Though everyone is so happy now to get that check. Mineral rights, trucks outside the Super 8, new motels going up every day. New money, new everything, where everything used to be so old. I can't even see the trees anymore, snow-covered and sheltering horses or cows. Some warm-blooded thing that has no need to know the score, no notion of who's winning or what's on the line. Robert, driver, Buick LeSabre. Figured I'd be further along in life by now. Figured I'd retire, do things for my kids, maybe move away, or at least fix what I've got here. Lot of houses boarded up, lot of houses torn down. Some, like mine, still standing but crumbling a little more every year, or even every season. Some winters I think one more good stiff wind will knock us down the hillside, quicker than a wrecking ball. The teardown crew came for Sada Santi's house last year, after they moved Greg's mom out to Minton to the care center. Used to be that me and Greg were friends, in a way. Used to be that he and I would fight, sometimes with each other, sometimes against. He'd talk to me about music, Frankie Lyman, Del Vikings, all of that. He used to joke that he was black, too, and it was true, almost. The Italians around here had a real hard time, so they lived side by side with us, and we were always good neighbors. In and out of each other's yards, though not houses. Not much. Greg would sometimes come over, make eyes at my sister Yvette, though everybody knew that couldn't happen. So Greg married a nice Italian girl, or maybe Czech, and he moved out to Spencerville. It's nice out there, but I hear there's still KKK. Don't believe the sign about the Quaker abolitionist. Maybe he did live there once, but that's been a long time ago. Somewhere along the way, the Italians became white. Greg became white, and I'm still black. If you believe things like that don't matter anymore, and if you think a knockdown house or a boarded-up house or a falling-down house are just facts, aren't something ugly, then someone's been lying to you, and maybe it's you. Ben, front seat passenger, Toyota Corolla. It's great no longer being the fat kid on the bus. I mean, I'm still the fat kid, but it's not as bad now that no one kicks my seat, asks about my man boobs. Which, okay, I know I have. I see myself, too, in the mirror, though sometimes I try not to. I don't know why Shauna drives me to school. She's like 3 years older than me, really cool. So yeah, I don't know why she'd want to hang out with me, much less give me rides to and from, every single day, even when I have band practice. She sits in her car reading until I'm done. She asked my parents one evening. It was really businesslike, except it was embarrassing. She told them some of what had been going on, bus-wise. My mom looked like she was the one who had been punched, spat on, called faggot, and oh yeah, asked about the man boobs. My dad wanted me to keep riding the bus to build character, but I think I have character enough already. Shauna and my mom worked it out. She comes a few minutes after my dad leaves for work, and she doesn't honk her horn or anything like that. She doesn't have to. I'm always ready to ride with Shauna. It's like this was always my seat, and she was always saving it for me. This is the last poem. Shauna, driver, Toyota Corolla. I've been thinking a lot about how everything is connected. One time in geometry class, we had a sub who talked to us about Fibonacci numbers, fractals. A lot of people were like, whatever. But I took notes, looked it all up later at home. Sometimes I talk about it with Ben on the way to and from school. That's one reason I rescued him from the bus, because I knew he was someone I could talk to like that. I know things about Ben that he doesn't even know yet, because he's younger than me, but also because that's how I am. It's not always so great, because I can't turn it off, and there are times when I would like to. It would be nice to just go to the football game like everyone else, you know? Not think so much. Just be a kid, I guess. I don't know what I am now. I just turned 18, and a couple of girls in my class have babies already. And I swear, one of them has like a 5-year-old. But do I feel like I could move out today, get a job, be a real person yet? Probably not. It's hard to imagine being somewhere else next year, either a couple of hours away or more like 7. We'll see how it all works out. My mom is still pushing hard for Belmont Tech or OU Zanesville, living at home. How so-and-so found that they saved a ton of money, it still felt like being at college, and then they didn't have all those loans. She and I both know that's not going to be me. I do think about Ben, what will happen when I'm not here to give him rides, keep him from getting picked on. But at least there's Skype, or we both got iPads for Christmas. Still not sure how we managed that. So now we have FaceTime, too. I think, even though it's not like we'll ever get married or anything, we don't like each other like that. That Ben and I will always be in touch somehow. It's like how I've read that in the ground, under all the rock and stuff, there are secret rivers, and that's where our water comes from. We're like that. Two secret rivers, side by side.
And now we have Jessica Walsh, and I'm not quite sure how to read what wasn't exactly a bio, it was kind of a letter to me, I think. But I'll try to pick through it to give you a sense, and this is probably a good way to start. Recently, a longtime friend and former professor said to me, "Your poetry is very good, but quite gendered." So I want you to know that I have not heard the word gendered out anywhere outside of the academic setting, but I do think that anybody whose work is gendered, any women whose work is gendered, can come to Woman Made Gallery. She'd be kind of right up our alley. She received second place in the Illinois Emerging Poets Competition, the Gwendolyn Brooks Award. She has two chapbooks out, which I believe are in back there, are they? Yes. In addition to numerous publications, she was nominated for the Pushcart Prize this year and teaches at Harper College. Jessica Walsh, give her a welcome.
Thank you so much. Thank you to everyone for being here, to Woman Made Gallery and to Nina Corwin for organizing this. It's really cool and it's nice to see so many people come out to hear this. My approach to this theme took me toward relationships, essentially, a sense of make or break and how people mix or fail to oil and water. And so I'll start with a poem called Parking Lot. Heads, it's Mountain Dew. Tails says antifreeze. In the cup wedged on the dash of that car you wish you'd kept. The one with no cup holders and the mat a false bottom slapped over a sinkhole. You are here because he is still on the tripwire strung tight between you. The best possible is only sweet. And you think either way. Let's flip and find out. You can bare your tongue throwing knives down your raw throat. You know enough to think the worst. The odds are slightly weighted. With the next couple, again, it kind of continues in my reading of relationships, I think, more or less. This is called State of the Current. The value of knowing you is a loaf of bread, and I am worth a tarp. You and me, we depend on context. Take me in this picture, dying for it, wrapped and gasping, refusing anyway. I don't want a picture. These days we're building a pyramid. Bread and tarp help us fail a bit later, nothing else. The value of you is a franc, and me, I am worth a peseta. Somebody could have used you and me. Now you are nostalgia, and I am trivia. The kids will laugh at either one. Back when we were kids, the rains came. You were shaking, curled around me. I was starving, and all we had was nothing to say. But say we had euros in our hands, I still wouldn't eat, and you would stand still in the rain. We'd buy wine and hash and spend the night angry together. The value of this rests on the bubble. The next one, I participated in a project called the Tupelo Press 3030 Project and in September, and I wrote a poem for each day, wrote and blogged a poem every day for 30 days, and it was an amazing experience. Poets, you should do it. It was really cool. and it helps raise money for a nonprofit press, and so that's a boon as well. During that time, I had to deal with a daughter's, my 7-year-old daughter was having social problems at school. And I was reflecting on having been a strange child and having a strange child and how you get to pick what people inherit and don't. And, so this is called Moribund. One, picture the author as a solid, world-struck child, surprised to learn she was failing at this human business. It turned out her clunky bursts of feeling were not creating a thing called friendship, but disrupting a thing called the process. She was bothering people. She did as told, hid at the corner desk with a pile of books, reading stories of children with no parents who never seemed to mourn or struggle or need. Two, these days I read myself to sleep on murder. Killers serial or snapped. The quiet family man with a stash of blood-soaked clothes who came home to his wife and slid into bed peacefully, as you are now. You don't know how I can take it, why I would send off my day with the brutal worst of this sinking world. Neither do I. I know I am afraid of everything but paper. Even you, sometimes, with your easy-spoken words, your friendships, with the people outside this house who I am not supposed to bother. I'm just going to read one more. The last cup of coffee before the end of the world. She's afraid of everything, and with that kind of material, I suppose she'll be right eventually. She nods as she announces that we're due for plague or horsemen or that long-promised tide of heat that will melt the suburbs into lakefront property. The threats mount. The fingerprint on the lid of her cup labors with viruses. The late evening sun kicks cancer cells into hysterical procreation. Somewhere a car, fast and heavy, prepares to surge through the landscape of saplings and petunias and smear its way across the patio of this particular Starbucks. Something will take us, or part of us, instantly or piecemeal, whichever is worse. She knows this to be fact. Indeed, it was hot today, and an uneasy wind churned street air turgid with car exhaust and millions of uncovered coughs. The sun falls low and bloody through iron smog. Thick darkness climbs in the east, inking out the city's silver angles. But just now, the mosquitoes are still larvae in the puddles of early June. Children roam, weightless with summer. Whatever cold, sweet drink I've chosen carries me to a forgotten day at the lake with my father, the day I first put my head underwater and delighted myself by surfacing alive. Raucous and dedicated stars begin pushing their way through the city's nighttime veil. Most likely, we'll be fine. And if not us, others. Thank you.
Some wonderful titles and a couple things that hit uncomfortably close to home. Anyone else? I am going to do something I very rarely do, which is to share one of my own, and I do that because it's such a theme that's so close to my heart. Before I bring up Joyce, I did forget to mention another juxtaposition, which I was made mindful of by your poems, though certainly also yours, Marilyn, which is right and wrong, and boy, is there room for discussion between the two. This is called Inhabitants of the Cusp, and I imagine that all of you who, at least those who think about astrology, which I don't, know that those are the few days that straddle one, whatever you call it, astrological sign and the other. Conceived under a whore's moon, no doors on our seventh house. We wear our bodies uneasily, as if our skins shrunk in the drying cycle, walk both sides of yellow lines, or sit at the edges of chairs, one tooth loose, the new one pushing close behind. We whistle out of both sides of our mouths, unable to escape the idea that point is only part of counterpoint, that things are rarely either here or there, but live in both places at once, like the nose on a Picasso face. I get restless in the presence of those who think borders are drawn in indelible ink. Carrying a leaky chalice and a diaspora on my back, it is only in the margins and borderlands that I can take off my shoes. Washed up on the cusp of one thing or another, I walk with one foot in Aries while the other lags behind in Pisces, being a middle child with two left feet to boot. Sometimes I've wondered if I was born under any sign at all. Modern transits into postmodern, and the composer feels old-fashioned. The writer has an identity crisis. The sculptor takes another chisel in midstream. I am forever awaiting the moment when gravity switches off and all those things we like to count on being anchored, frying pans, mailboxes, the coffee out of cups, and then the cups themselves float silently into the air. A fly ball arcs into the summer sky, loses itself in a post-industrial sun, neither here nor there. It is in that place we find ourselves. So I'm going to bring up Joyce Guildenstern, Goldenstern, who is a Chicago resident who's been adapting folk tales, writing fiction, and living by fiction for a very long time. She occasionally writes poetry as well. I'm not sure if you consider yours, what you sent, poetry, but it was like, it was prose poetry. Her print, her work has appeared in Western Humanities Review, North American Review, Phantom Drift, and many others. She has a full-length collection of fiction scheduled for publication by ELJ Publications in fall of 2015. Welcome, Joyce. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. So as Nina said, I think that what I'm going to read is based on the Magritte exhibit, which many of you might have seen this year at the Art Institute. But actually, it's not that exhibit that it's based on. I guess one advantage of getting old is that you keep seeing these artists come back to the Art Institute. So I saw a Magritte exhibit at the Art Institute in the 90s. I'm not exactly sure what year, probably 94, something like that. Was it? Okay. And so that was the one that really blew me away, although there was a lot of repetition with this one, but it was really the first time I'd seen so much Magritte, and I was studying linguistics at the time, and for somebody who's interested in language, I think Magritte is very interesting because he really stresses the arbitrariness of language. I do have some of the paintings that I reference marked in this book because I'm sure there are some people that aren't that familiar with his work, so I'll pass that along if you want to look at it. Hopefully the, you know, what I've written will stand up without really knowing the work that well. So there are six parts, and this is a one. Around the black flame, a halo of shadow flickers, an anti-halo of sorts. The eggs all locked up in its cage. Which sign means hope? The apple, the hand, the stone, or the wall? Pick one. In the evening, after the hour of closing, we walk the museum halls alone. Alone in the evening, after the hour of closing, we walk the museum halls. We walk the museum halls alone in the evening after the hour of closing. This is not an apple. This is not a pipe. The artist stares at an egg. His brush paints a bird of prey. When we dream, the world presents itself as a dream. When we are awake, we must speak of our ignorance. Two. Consider the blood painted on the naked woman's face. Consider the tranquil room. The murderer lingers by the phonograph, listening, his coat folded over the back of a chair, his hat on his coat. Witness witnessing faces lined up in the window like shameless apples on a sill. The police just there, statues for a composition. All men are mortal and wear bowler hats. The murderer is a man. The murderer is mortal. The murderer wears a bowler hat. What Sherlock supposed, logic alone can solve a crime. Three, we have seen these two before, in the back seat kissing, fucking in the swimming pool, disappearing from the party, making a scene in the hall. Here we have the lovers. Two, 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 the first even number, a natural pair, not of two minds, not of two hearts, not of two choices. Blind the lovers kiss, blind the lovers scorn us, blind the lovers count to two. Under a blanket, under a towel, the lovers see what they want to see, out of sight, out of. A tree falls alone in the forest, the sound that one lover kissing makes. Four. The train speaks of relativity, and the clock, of course. And slowly Einstein speaks of it. His hands move following the strains of a violin, the hands of a conductor, the hands of a clock, the train, a flashlight mounted to the floor, a mirror mounted to the ceiling, the path of light and its return. That, my friend, equals time. Someone on the platform, someone else on the train. Time could slow down, now you see, stop even, depending on where you are, how fast you go. The photograph of the artist standing next to his painting is a work of art. The work of art of the artist standing next to his work of art is a work of art. The title, Time Stabbed or Time Transfixed, depending on the translation. A title, Magritte says, is a title. It needn't tell us anything. Five. The painting shows a real hand holding a real leaf. Your hand is real and holds a leaf. Are you asking forgiveness? Are you making amends? If someone were to touch your hand, would they feel the smooth fat of your palm, a natural encounter? Your eyes, though, tell another story. Glass buttons with Elmer's right where they belong on the bald wood of your face. Your lips transfixed in a permanent O are not for speaking. Can one believe in your arm, shrouded by a towel? Your arm? One cannot be sure. In the clouds framed by a window, could they be real? As real as your hand? As real as the artist's hand? Six. I believe a cloud in a painting is a cloud and nothing more. I believe a cloud in the sky is just a cloud. Not a castle, not a mother, not the king of heaven, nor a hawk. Not angels here. I believe a cloud in a painting is a painting of a cloud and nothing more. And if, for example, a cloud were to float on a champagne glass larger than a mountain, then that cloud would be nothing, or rather, cloud. And if with scissors the artist were to cut a shape of a bird out of the sky and paste that bird on canvas, then the clouds there in that sky, in that bird, are clouds and nothing more. Consider a cloud on a canvas in front of a sky filled with clouds. Consider a painting of a cloud on a canvas in front of a sky filled with clouds. That is a cloud. That is a painting. That is not a cloud. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Within the first minute, you said the words, pick one. And it just really struck me how central that idea is to this theme, you know, of right or wrong, either or. And that so much of what happens in our world of black and white thinking is because people are invested in the one and excluding the others. Luckily today, you don't have to worry about excluding anything. You can listen to everybody. You can check out the work. You can eat the food. You can talk to each other. It was pretty good. Like how I did that? Yeah. It doesn't usually come out that way. But in the meantime, let's see you all back here at... it's 2:20 now. Let's see you back at about 2:35 and Poets a little bit earlier so we can figure out. Actually, Poets in there at like 2:30 so we can figure out where to take a gorgeous picture of you. Okay, a round of applause for everyone in the first half. Check out their books. People's books are back there. Poets don't make much money. At least not at poetry, but buying their book and selling books is an act of love. I do want to thank all of the poets who not only are sharing their writing today, but also snacks. the gallery being believe it or not, on a shoestring. I mean, there's obviously a lot of overhead, but we actually need the contributions of everyone, and food is one way of making this kind of a multi-sensory and very welcoming experience. So thank you guys for that. And speaking of things like participation and all of nurturing and all of that, if any of you feel like moved to become members of this incredible gallery, it supports us, and it also keeps you informed of all of the wonderful things that go on. With the new executive director, I expect there to be more salons, artist discussions, etc. I expect, that's what I've been told to expect. And, you know, every executive director brings their imprint. She will swim. She will not sink. And she'll bring some of her own ideas to the fore. So, our next poet is Cara Candido. She's the author of Spectator, University of Utah Press, and winner of the, I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name right, Aga Shahid Ali Poetry Prize. In Taste of Cherry, University of Nebraska Press, two beautiful books that are on the table back there. Winner of the Prairie Schooner Book Prize in Poetry. I actually met her. We've been on a lot of the same journals, but there's an anthology called A Face to Meet the Faces, an anthology of contemporary persona poetry, which is something you may want to look for. You know, they're all poems in the voice of, so, you know, Marilyn's poems were all persona poems, and that this gives you like such a wide tasting of that genre of work. So that's how I got to meet Cara. Originally, we were on a panel talking about the book and some of the poems in it. So she's got a whole lot of other impressive things on this bio, but I think you probably impressed enough already. Cara Candido, come on up.
Thanks. Thank you, Nina. Thank you, Kurt, and thanks, fellow readers, and everyone for being here today. I'll start off by reading the first poem in my second book. My second book has like a reoccurring motif of Federico Garcia Lorca, the Spanish poet. After I finished my first book, I was just very cynical. Imagine that. And so I started to think of why I liked poetry in the first place. And Lorca is one of those reasons. But the more I kind of spoke with him or to him or at him, the more I realized there are certain things that separate us as opposed to unite us. One is gender and the other is historical moment. Initiation number 5, Lorca. He is standing at the foot of my bed with an insanely tragic smile and a syringe full of lead. He is sitting beside me in a bloodless body, stroking the pink sheets with eyes like a fruit that's never in season, burning casinos and countries I'll never visit pass over the room. I am here to learn how to suffer more beautifully. Outside at the bus stop, thin men in scrubs read about nanobots, and maybe they can map the malignant cells unspooling in my marrow, or the best, fastest path of a bullet entering the chest. Inside, in another dimension, we are riding two lame mares to the pasture where I am ravaged by centaur after centaur, never a sadder. Bodies matter, how they break open, which animals we let inside us. I am here to learn how to suffer more beautifully, to smile for the white air and give everything away. So the second poem I'm going to read is called, well, I was a grad student, like, I don't know, sometime in the early 2000s. It all seems like one decade. And this guy who's often on NPR, and now when I hear his voice, I feel like I have PTSD or something. He's a poet, and he came to my grad program and proceeded to hit on all of the female students in completely not subtle ways. And so this is kind of like dedicated to him, whose name I will not mention. Bestiary. I consider the famous poet's majesty when he recites an ode to my ass. Left bank beret askew on the alopecia, an expired visa, sardonic deployment of data. After the reading, holding court in the chiaroscuro, partaking of eclairs and smoked scotch. Is this tasteless? He asks. Yes. Though we have a kind of alliance, his come-ons for my silence, his bouquet of meme for my, how to say, proximity, as in the documentary where a man lives among Kodiak bears and gets eaten. As in, of course, I get in the car and he blasts giant steps all the way to the pier. Why not admit that the weather is at least panegyric? With his Zippo aglow, he speaks of a wife whose name might be Vera, who might be a surrealist reporter, a connoisseur of vodka, omnivorous in her house dress. One hand touring the ecotone of my back, he mimics Khrushchev. He makes himself laugh. And I remember a family trip to Fort Lauderdale, the marina where my father admired other men's boats. I never spoke there either, a pure spectator, though manatees swam beneath our feet, so free I wanted to smash a fist beneath the surface. One's back had been cut by a propeller. Is this scary? It seemed to cry. Would you like to join me? I did not reply. Was that tasteless? Was that an invitation? Does silence mean consent? Too many highballs, bottom feeders, one-liners. It's like sitting at the stern of a glass bottom boat watching blowfish, how they devour chunks of cheap white bread. It's like, I don't know. And I kept looking. I was like, you're an adult. You do something. But no. The professors were just like, whoa. I personally would kick ass, but that's just me, right? Okay. I guess the next two poems that I'll read are, they loosely have to deal with the binary, Nina. I kind of forgot to mention this. The way that I'm thinking about oil and water is the binary, like between domestic and foreign. And here and there, and yeah. And the next two poems have to deal with a kind of contemporary violence that's sadly pervading our culture. There are lots of guns here, and we cannot trust the refrigerator. When I return from the doctor with no diagnosis, you're standing in your underwear, waving a bag of rotting vegetables like a monstrance. We cannot trust the radishes in the bag, the color of a sad radish's heart, the minute it's pulled from the ground. And the rain has a voice like a president who cannot believe something he has just said about security or debt. We cannot trust the veteran on the first floor who stalks the parking lot barefoot in the rain, then backs his truck into six different spots. We cannot trust that he hates you for being an immigrant, or that he has a gun, but maybe one day soon we'll dial 911. And I do not think I could write the transformative elegy, the one that turns from grief to consolation in memory to an affirmation of immortality. Forgive me. There are so many situations to diffuse that one wonders why buy fresh produce in the first place. Let's bury our faces in the parsley. Let's seal up the day like a body bag. I always feel bad. It's like I can't write a light poem. And then things you think are funny, people are like, that's just disturbing. Sorry, my bad. Do you guys know Joshua Clover? He's a poet. I think he's on the West Coast. He's like my favorite poetry nerd. I have fantasies of talking about Marxism in a small conference room with him. I don't know. So his first book was very influential to me. He has this poem called Radiant City that's a reflection on the Los Angeles riots in the 90s after the Rodney King verdict. And this poem is kind of a response to that, that takes on a really kind of relevant yet depressing connotation in light of certain recent events like Ferguson, and I won't even talk about it. But anyway, this takes place in Mexico and it deals loosely with the drug war. Camino Real. First, it was one checkpoint, and then it was another checkpoint. On the highway between DFA and Puebla, two federales boarded the bus and ordered the women off. We tend to think, not me, or just me. One more in a sight rifle across his back. Another pointed a video camera at our faces. At these moments, we tend to think massacre, as in no longer a number, or biopower, as in Foucault's botched orgy visions. The one with the assault rifle said, quite los lentes, and I was on my knees, as in prayer, the compliance position, pure submission. The federales laughed, and I was just another silly woman on her knees at a checkpoint south of a Volkswagen factory where Mexicans manufacture German cars, as in high performance engines, speed management. Not bullets, but the red record button. The mouth effaced by the camera saying, Rubia, linda, ojos verdes. To my left, a covered well for animals. The assumption is that the missing are dead or in safe houses. The assumption is slippage of language. To my right, the bus where Victor watched me watching the camera pan in on my face. Blue curtains. The smell of animals and cooking oil. We were, by this time, already leaving. As in, all of this was no longer our problem. Checkpoints, surveillance, narco-terrorism, the DEA doctrine, species management, footage of Rodney King, Katrina, Los Angeles, New Orleans, the National Guard. We call it a lifestyle decision. These mornings spent reading El Norte on our iPads, studying the photos of headless bodies hanging from bridges. Biopower. A covered well for animals. The squinting and trying not to piss oneself. The not me of it, which is the final take. So I'll read two more poems. This is actually an erasure. I've always been jealous of people who can do like conceptual stuff. I have to wait until it comes to me, or I don't know. So I tried to write some conceptual poems a few summers ago. I wrote a series of erasures, and this, I guess, deals with the whole binary of like domestic versus foreign. It's an erasure. Yeah. Oh, right. So it's, I don't even know, Nina? No. it's a, like a piece of poetry that takes language from another text. In my case, it was non-poetic texts. And you only take the words that are there, but you have kind of free rein over what you decide to omit. And I allowed myself to include some gerunds that weren't already there. I don't know. I'm not that hardcore. So, this is the first of a series of erasures of U.S. marriage-based immigration petition forms I-130, I-485, and G-325A. The alien spouse's application. In conclusion, I petition. I am minor. I am physically present. I, being a refugee, military, junta, polygamist, continuously, derivatively use black ink. I, being a communist, maternal uncle, war criminal, am applying for an adjustment of status because I have witnessed any of the above. I, being a physically present alien, petition. I am neither native nor citizen. Additional space is needed. It's kind of, I felt like I'm onto something. These poems just kind of write themselves, but it totally stops after a little while. I thought it was a new gimmick. I'm like, I could just pump out a third book this afternoon, but no, it didn't happen at all. This is the last poem I'll read. It's not really important, I guess, but I'm one of those people, like, I can't do camping. I'm terrified of nature. And when I was visiting my now husband in Mexico City, there was this like prolonged blackout that entailed not having running water. And I was like, I need to shower. What do we do? So this poem kind of takes place during that unclean and quiet time. Anyway, not really. It's called Monologue During a Blackout. What about a zebra? Suppose you had to come back as a zebra, knowing you'd spend your life trampling the savanna with the desperation of an open during construction sign. Once, stepping off a plane onto the blacktop of an ancient city where my father was born, I smelled burning garbage and understood anything can happen. Often, it doesn't. The rain stops, we are not washed away. I do not glide down five black flights to greet the electric truck. But when the air conditioner aches on again, how blunt, how exquisite. No, I don't want to be famous. Yes, the radio. A man with the voice of a woman sings about a woman. The sky, you say, looks darker now. Would you call white a bright color? Would you like Bach better through headphones? I mean, the seismic privacy of tiny, angry gods beating your middle ear. I mean, to make you dizzy. Here, run your thumb along my chin. While two workers shimmy down a high voltage pole and everything that can pass between two people, pleasure, shock, surveillance, the static of it, private or public, draws shut like curtains across a first class cabin. What I thought in the dark, forget it. A group of zebras is called a harem. We call them black. We call them white. Thanks.
My therapist part keeps going back to the conceptual from the image and the metaphor. But, Kara, when you were saying just me or not me or just me, that just really said something so important about how we so often experience the world, you know, particularly if you feel like there's something wrong with you, you forget that you're, you know, among a world of people that is so large that there are very few, that it's very unlikely that there isn't somebody who is in community with you, even if you don't know them or see them. And not me being, you know, the ultimate in denial, the ultimate in creating a great you outside of yourself. So thank you for those wonderful poems and that captured idea. Carly Sachs actually sent work in for the last reading, did you, for Boxes? And she provides a living example that if you are not accepted for one reading, does not by any means mean that I don't like your work a lot and that it might get you here on the next try or the next. So I'm really glad you kept trying. Carly is the author of The Steam Sequence and the editor of the anthology The Why and Later, a collection of poems about rape and assault. Her poems and stories have been published near and far and included in the Best American Poetry series and read on NPR's Selected Shorts. Impressive. She's currently a yoga teacher and a doctoral student in rhetoric and composition at Kent State University. Thanks for making the ride over here, Carly Sachs.
I think I'm the shortest reader. It's exciting. So it's funny that you mentioned not writing happy poems. So my mom's like, wow, your poems are about rape and assault and the Holocaust. Like, when are you going to write something funny? But I think I'm not going to read anything funny today. I do have funny things, but I think there is this union of, like, in the tragedy, there's comedy. Instead of trying to say this and that, and or oil and water, I think a lot of my work is really about union, even though it's seemingly disunion. So I'm going to start with some newer work and then go back to my older work. So this first poem is about a shooting that never really happened on the Kent State campus last spring. There was a man with a gun and nothing happened, but so much the campus was locked on lockdown and everybody was doing their part and no one was hurt or injured except for the shooter. But it was like this really big deal and all the like social media was happening and students were on lockdown and it was really, anyway, I think the poem speaks to it. Breakfast. The orchid ablaze on the dining room table. After the man last night with a gun on campus shot a single bullet into the ground outside. Outside next to the building where I teach my students about language and how to form an argument. Right now I am holding a fork instead of a pen, instead of a gun. The subject of the sentence is me, a woman eating an egg. A woman writing a poem. What is the consciousness of the objects we act upon? Upon my small plate, the yolk breaks open. The egg from a local farm. Someone who I don't know raised this chicken who bore this egg. Someone who I don't know raised this child. Last night he wore shorts as the cool April evening met his skin as he held a gun in his hands. In the evening, a boy was held by what hell and his holding back. A purple orchid held up by the breakfast table. A fork resting on an empty plate. The distance between lives. Someone raised this gun, all its small parts. Last night, the sliver of the moon met the silver of the handgun, and for a moment, the world shimmers. All the small pieces, barrel, trigger, bricks, blades of grass, before the exhale of a bullet, the punctuation of a bullet, a shot shimmering into silence. The silence of the ground outside the building where I teach. After the man last night with a gun used the language of a gun in an argument in which he is the subject and the object of a violence held both too close and so far from the violet blossoms on the table of a woman eating breakfast. This is a love poem. Date night. It will and will never be the fairy tale. One of you will have a secret, and the other one will have a bigger one. One of you will not be completely faithful, and the other one of you will drink a lot. One of you will run away for weeks at a time, and the other one will have an incurable disease. One of you will dream about fighter jets, and the other one about being unfaithful. But tonight, date night. One of you will find the perfect restaurant, and the other one of you will get the best table in the house. You'll have the Beaujolais Nouveau and the Carpaccio. You will feed each other everything on your plates, pastas, problems, and panna cotta, saying in this economy how lucky you both are to have jobs and each other. Coming home, you'll hold hands as you walk past a man drawing a bow across a saw in a subway station. You'll both close your eyes, thinking how beautifully you've hurt and loved each other, how anything is possible, that a saw can stand in for a violin, and here you are underground kissing while everyone else rushes home. No horse, no sunset, only a rusty handsaw playing love's sharp, sweet song. So I used to be a bartender, and I had this idea that I was going to write a poem for every single drink that people ever ordered. But as I was telling my friends, they all started to sound like the same. So after about two or three of these, I stopped. But this one is Irish Car Bomb. In another version, I'd be blonde. Tits up to my throat. Tattoos. My grandmother calls me Cherry. I am blood cells in a jar, the stem you knot with your tongue tonight to impress some other girl whose hair is less shiny than mine. Another round and pull stick. I call the shots. We don't serve that here. You, all folded bills and matchbook. In the tea light's gleam, we do Irish car bombs, and I think, who names these drinks nowadays? You say it's supposed to taste like a milkshake. It doesn't. Okay, maybe there was a funny one in there. That was the drink my coworker liked to order at the end of the night. This is terrible. Souvenir. That afternoon, which one? Was it Cleveland? You held them all, careful as you are with eggs. You're getting older. But in the snow globe of your heart, it's always Tuesday. There's the cottage you will never enter, the sword you will never draw. What honeymoon is this on your dresser? Plastic desire, promise of change. Every time you shake it, go back to that highway rest stop or souvenir shop, memory's darling. Yes, you had to have it, the glitter settling like ash. Go ahead, just try and break it open. I like the highway rest stop. I think we stopped at like every single highway rest stop on the way here. This one is called Real Butter. When you invite me over, I like to open the door to the fleeting world within a fleeting world. A refrigerator is not a Zen garden or minimalist sculpture or graveyard for half-full mustards and mayonnaise. Takeout containers say you're not here or you don't like to dirty your hands. I look for local cheese, milk that comes in jars, and homemade jam. I want a good party, a gathering of just enough. ginger and tamari, local eggs and arugula, maybe cornichons or at least kosher dills, a French blue, a Sauvignon Blanc. Meet me with your figs and heirloom tomatoes. I want to say, have you tried their stout or met Anders, the cheesemaker at the farmer's market? But I'll be happy if there's real butter and cream for my morning coffee. In some languages, hunger and desire share the same root. And this last poem of the new ones is called Sawdad. And I think it means, it's one of those, there's so many words that are actually not translatable into English, but this one is kind of like a nostalgia for something that never actually really was. So, Sawdad. The universe is always leaving messages. A quote on a tea bag, a song on the radio. My mother believes the touch of wind The universe is always leaving messages. A quote on a tea bag, a song on the radio. My mother believes the touch of wind is her father from the other world telling her it's okay. In the park, someone spelled I love you in flowers, and I want to believe it's for me, my inner voice speaking to my outer doubter, the way I had cut class and interlaced my fingers around my grandfather's when he was in the hospital. That's where my mother found us after work, silent together, in the language underneath the language. How do you translate a breath or a kiss or name a loss? How the sound trails off quietly, the way dusk embraces the trees along the highway, everything dark and passing. But I want you still, the way you were when you were sober, before the garage had the holes you made in it, before my heart was worn thin like cotton, before the skin of fear could peek through. When the deer gather in the yard, I watch them looking in at me, as if they were either looking past me, or stunningly lost, bereft as a window, blank and waiting to hold whatever arrives. So I'm just going to read a few from my book, The Steam Sequence, which is about memory and the Holocaust. And I think the reason for including this is that the story is, lives in the memory of a fictitious Holocaust survivor who was actually in love and with a Nazi soldier. And so the story kind of unfolds of like what happened in this space. And it begins with an epigram from Primo Levi from his poem Shema. You who live secure in your warm houses, who return at evening to find hot food and friendly faces, consider whether this is a woman, without hair or name, with no more strength to remember, eyes empty and womb cold as a frog in winter. Consider that this has been. In the tea kettle, a train, which stopped running a long time ago, though she knows at any moment the whistle, and she will have to board. The train moves through her body. In her letters, she writes, I am healthy and feel well. Words, engines, who reads, sees, knows what the truth is. In the tea, the woman bathing in a blue bathroom, steam rising from the woman is burning. The dim light in the room, the moon. The woman lives in a series of dark rooms that open into each other. She goes around all day opening and closing doors. She dreams of the blue bathroom with its cool, smooth tiles and the tub large enough to swallow her whole. If you ask her, she will tell you she is burning in this water. They let certain women keep their hair. Those were the soldiers' women, always the ones most recently off the train, who were given soap and water, then taken naked to a concrete room where the soldiers would shove the heads of their rifles inside them. Sent back to the women's barracks, beauty gone, the other women picked on the bones, scavenge these broken bodies for jewelry, a hidden tube of lipstick, the mirror, though no one wanted to see what they had become.
Thank you.
Chardé Murphy is going to wrap up the reading today. And I know now why I thought you had a master's is because it looks like you have worked with Joy L. McSweeney and some very notable others. She attended the University of Notre Dame, graduated with a bachelor's in studio art. Her poetry has been published in Action, Yes, Joint, Revolver, and Lit. Dream Machine is her first book of poetry. She currently works in South Bend as a silk painter with Silk Creations, a collective of women artists, and serves as the artist in residence at Dismas House, a community focused on the reentry of the formerly incarcerated. You go, girl. Come on up.
Hi. I'm going to be reading to you guys from Dream Machine, which is my first book of poetry. And I was really excited to be chosen to read here as part of this series because I felt like the theme of the show was just very much in tune with Dream Machine and the way in which I feel very much like it's a manuscript about taking those dichotomies and like just making them live together, whether they like it or not. It's very much about like bothness. And I'm just gonna hop right in and we'll only kind of like comment a little bit. I'd like to just kind of like hit you with it. The first poem that I'm going to read to you is sort of like what I call the PSA poem of the manuscript. And it's sort of a directive on how to listen to these poems. The first six poems are the poems that I submitted, so I wanted to bring them here into the space and share them with you. And the last six poems that I'll read are poems that make me feel very in tune with like the prophetic energy of dreams. The title of the book is Dream Machine. So there's a lot of dreams in it. And so it just makes me feel in touch with like the way that going back and rereading some of these poems makes me feel like the energy of dreams is so everywhere at once, like historically. Dream Machine. Dream, noun, dream, a train of thoughts, images or fancies passing through the mind during sleep, a vision during sleep, the state in which this occurs. Machine, noun, machine. A structure regarded as functioning as an independent living body without mechanical involvement. A material or immaterial structure, a scheme or plot. Anything that transmits force or directs its application. The Oxford English Dictionary. Six. Do not pretend that you do not know how to sleep purely for the dream. Do not ignore the moon streaming high-speed light into your window. Do not deny wishing that you were not sleeping alone. Do not fear the boogeyman. He is no more real than the lover born in the depths of your dreams. Do not seek to control the way you do in waking life. for you will only ruin what prophecy you may receive. Do not knot yourself up over the meaning. Let it instead fall through your fingers like sand. "377. The remains increase unstably. There is no hope of reemerging. One only travels further forward, deeper still. I worry over the end. Is it a magmatized core I'm strangling towards? Is it a perpendicular horizon mist? Will I approach my own pupil with a cellophane lens? The waking is weary. Some quadrants are cruel. A hill ripe with dandelions and rock crystal lilies. The sunniest mound. Small girls are raped behind a portable blackboard and discarded. They play with dolls that have no eyes. Their sweaters catch perfume fire, threatening their stiff spritz curls. Okay, I just feel like I need to like breathe a little bit. Okay. "15. The sun did not barrel through my window like a freight train. While it crouched behind the clouds, the skin covered with hair tightened and madly acupunctured. I told my mother, I told her, shrieking as she foisted me upon that pussing, wounded nightmare man. In Arabic, I run away, pitched myself into ditch and days and milk that was spoiled half and half. The best and worst delayed hangover, hungover, gray day, if this is what you call morning, I don't want to know who you would call a slut. Probably some saint." "64. I am stalking you. After work, you catch a bus to Jackson, and when you get under the rude lights of the casino marquee, you blush a golden beet pink. You place your beanie babies atop the slot machine. They emit a dead spin plasticity, happy and poorer than you might think. Aubergine cotton candy hair crawling out of a casket. Death is a deal breaker, full of loud melancholy ricocheting off tabernacles. I cannot stand to be away from you, but I cannot absolve you of your sins. I'm sorry." 311. "I put my babies in a feather crib. Mama, mama, they timpani, they trill, they gargoyle. When will the dog kill the Indian? Only if malefic visions of the past erupt and people jump from concave mulch bridges. Gather round my pussy willows. I'm going to tickle you. I want to watch you vomit laughter until your corneas burst and fizzle. Shut up. Now the sound of your existence is like a fork dragging along aluminum. I could have aborted you when I had the chance." 8. "Mama, did I ram you like a calf anxious to flow the milk? Was I too hungry for you? Could you smell the matricide on my baby breath? Oh, but I love you like a trash bin in the wind spewing rancid garage meat mothballs and gin-soaked panties. In a room with acetone strips cerulean felt for carpet, I strangle you, but you won't die. You're the queen of the penis pendulum. You're a pseudo-xenophile with your porcupine prison warden and your nylon merkin. If only I was brave enough to slice open your lymphoma, to vomit inside your jack-o'-lantern shit grin, to push you through my womb and make you mine. I'd have you drawn and catarred, diasporate all the pieces of you that too closely resembled mine. Don't you want the best for me? Let me watch you die. Nine. Does it turn you on? Do you like that? You've got the best mouth. I like those tits. You married? Please don't tell me you don't got a boyfriend. Where's your man? Haven't you ever been in love? Come here. You don't have to pee. It's supposed to feel that way. Promise me. If you tell, we'll get in trouble. If you ever want to touch it, don't use your teeth. Did you? I had a dream we went to the movies. She told me she was always jealous of you. I want you. I want you still. I love you. Don't you need love too? Unless you don't want to be loved. Can I call you sometime? I can't get your number. What's your name, baby? Stuck up bitch, black bitch, fat bitch, ugly bitch. What if I told you I desired you in a different way? The pipes were flooding the abandoned mall, and this woman in rags, this bag lady, just kept screaming at me, and obscene, and with a fire hose, and with dogs, and the wet dog smell left me gagging and cast away in middle America. I was stranded, and I could not go down the escalator. I was scared. There were no stairs. Joan Crawford was after me, alone. 11. In the afterglow, I dream calamity. Never again the pillow princess. Never again the prude. Spiders, fires, Tupperware, oh my. To have lit that man on fire. He was a husband, a father. His ghost hounded me through mountains of polycarbonate and latex projecting flashbacks of his pregnant bride. In grocery aisles, baby blob arachnids, bowling glass Coca-Cola bottles. I was high on obituates. I had deja vu. I had multiple strokes chained to an Elmo wallet peeking out of her white trash denim pocket. It doesn't matter whether you're celebrating General E. Lee or MLK. 101. The fall of the animals began with the birds. They've always been proud. Both crocodiles and birds have beautiful scales, but birds are the only ones showing off. A quick fox and a blue chickalope. My boot flap bruise is sweeting. My eyes sweat saline. I bleed tangerine. Amish glitter bombed. My hands pruned in the sun like blowjobs on pagan Christmas. A disturbing old sea dog gnaws on an alarm clock. Higher education won't equalize us. My heart is the Queen Elizabeth. 144. The hoodoo ghost hijacked the dream. I bolt up bolster each time. I count the feathers and the corks in the numinous bowl, sit on the edge of the bed. They wait for me, painting as a pastime from sewing menstrual cramps into baked tongues. I sneak so coots at the ineluctable mirror. I duck lip the rug with my toes. I hear the death gurgle grudging through the negative space. I hear the death rattle inside my esophagus. The heartbeat rapid rabbit flesh about the snapped neck. The air couldn't filter into the caporal lung or the incepted dream. I hear it crunching on my tendons. I haven't been kleinomanic for some time. Abracadabra can't save me now. And this is the last poem that I'll read. It's the last poem in the book, and its title is One. I will waste time dreaming. I will confront the broken men mess. I can wheel unsteady. I ape ear the spring equinox. I must jail sentence. I wonder how resisting the pressure juxtaposed. I sense interplay unfinessed. I have the cameras moving trained any muscle. I clung like thirst. I prefer my feather inside the world. I saw blindness erase the swaying wonder. I Bartleby be talking about anything. I wanted the sprightly. I feel here. I'm not. I cling to these words. Thank you.
I kept thinking throughout your reading that these poems take no prisoners. And your working with incarcerated women really kind of comes close to home, because that's pretty much where I started my work many, many years ago. And I thought, well, that work kind of frees prisoners, which is a good place for us to wrap up. I thank you all for being with us this afternoon. The gallery closes at 4, so we're going to want to help them close up and whatever. But spend a few moments to talk to the artists, buy their books, maybe help pile some of those books along the wall, and come back and see us. The first Sunday in February, our reading theme is documentation. And of course, not all writing is documentation, but poems in the form of recipes or instruction manuals or something that holds these truths to be self-evident, or anything like that. If you know people who have written that kind of work, pass the word, spread the word, and I hope we'll see you again. Thank you all. Thank you, poets. Thank you, listeners. Come on back.